From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If the economy felt unstable before COVID-19, now many Michiganders don't know if they'll have jobs to return to.
The overwhelming thing that I hear from individuals is just fear of uncertainty. What is the next day, the next week, the next month going to look like?
One state lawmaker proposes a path out of the economic turmoil. Also, today, Congressman Andy Levin on a small business focus for stimulus efforts.
The crisis is phenomenal, and I don't begrudge a medium-sized business for getting help. I want them to, but we really should be helping the smallest businesses first.
And we'll speak with two curators about what Detroit's artists are doing to witness this moment.
We have this opportunity to stop and look. I mean, if we lose this opportunity, we're fools.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. A little later in the program, we talk with Congressman Andy Levin, who says the current COVID crisis is an important opportunity to rethink how we treat and better protect the natural world. But first, with everything that's happening right now, a lot of us have just had to take things one day at a time. But as the weeks roll on, some are beginning to ask the question, what is Michigan's recovery going to look like? With us now is Michigan House Representative Sarah Anthony, a Democrat from Lansing. She's the rep for House District 68, and she's been working on one program recently passed into law that could be an important stepping stone in the rebuilding of Michigan's economy. Sarah Anthony, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
First off, how are you and your family doing right now?
We are doing well. My family is healthy, thank goodness. We've had a lot of individuals around our community that have passed away due to COVID-19, and it's really impacting especially our faith community here in the mid-Michigan area, but our family is doing well. They're safe and they're staying home, so we're doing well. Thank you for asking.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear about folks you know, and we're thinking about you for sure. This is a time when I imagine you're in a position to hear a lot of voices from the community right now in a very unique and direct way as people are reacting to what's going on. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been hearing from constituents about the kind of fears or hopes that people have?
Absolutely. I think the two big groups that I've been hearing from every single day are business owners who are trying to figure out how to stay afloat during the pandemic. And we've received just hundreds of calls from individuals who are filing for unemployment, some for the very first time. And they are frustrated with the system. They are nervous about their ability to pay rent and feed their families. And so individuals are very stressed. There is folks in the community who have limited access to the internet and don't have the resources to actually navigate many of our state systems. And so I think that the pandemic is really showing us many of the cracks in our existing system. But the overwhelming thing that I hear from individuals is just fear of uncertainty. What is the next day, the next week, the next month going to look like for individuals who are ultimately just trying to survive?
To that end, before the pandemic struck Michigan, which now feels like about 100,000 years ago, you worked with two other reps, Ben Frederick and Ken Horn, on something called the Reconnect Program. And it was designed to help out workers who were perhaps not right out of high school, but still at a fairly early stage of life, who've become disconnected with the workforce. What was it that you wanted to do for them?
Yeah. I mean, so my background is I spent 10 years at an organization called the Michigan College Access Network. It was an organization that helped essentially close our gap in post-secondary degrees and credentials in Michigan. And so this has really been my life's work. And I was really honored to work with two Republicans in the House and the Senate to make this bill a reality. You know, the governor in her 2019 and 2020 State of the States addresses talked about the Reconnect program as a way to fill the almost 80,000, unfilled skilled trade jobs. And really just, again, make sure that our workers are prepared for, you know, what's next in the economy, and to obviously just address the needs of the workforce in Michigan, because there's a huge gap.
Can you explain how ReConnect works?
Basically, it is a pathway to a meaningful career for what I like to call folks who are maybe disconnected. Maybe they didn't right out of high school decide to go off to a 2 or 4 year program in one of our community colleges or 4 year institutions. So ReConnect is designed for individuals who are 25 years or older, who have their high school diploma or an equivalency, and haven't already earned an associate's or a bachelor's degree. And so this program will be designed for Michigan residents who, again, you know, fill out their FAFSA form, their financial aid forms, and they apply for a Pell eligible program at one of our eligible institutions. So, you know, again, I think this will be, you know, when the governor and you know, us as legislators started to dream up this program, we never thought that this would be something that we would be discussing in the context of a recession. But
right.
When you look at our record numbers of unemployment rates right now, many people have reached out to me and said, you know, I've got the time right now. I'm sitting home, I'm filing for unemployment, or I'm receiving assistance. And when this is over, I want a different career. I want to, you know, gain a skill or a trade, or have a, you know, additional credential or piece of paper that's going to be valuable after the pandemic, so that I can be in a better position to provide for my family. So I think this is providing an opportunity for folks to really look at what skills do they need in a post-COVID workforce.
So what is the short-term impact of COVID-19 on the law? Is it still going to go forward as planned?
So there's good news and there's bad news. So the good news is that, you know, the bill has been signed into law. So on April 4th, the governor in her home signed it into law and then took a selfie and sent it to me. So we're excited about that. The policy is in place. But unfortunately, and also rightfully so, the money that was earmarked to fund the program has been repurposed to address our most immediate coronavirus related needs. So this is, you know, emergency resources as related to the, you know, for healthcare needs and, you know, to really make sure that we're addressing things related to the pandemic. So while the money for the program has been repurposed, this is where, you know, individuals like myself, our allies on the Republican side, will need to start looking at what does the budget look like for this year in terms of our state budget, but also having some strategic conversations at the federal level. I know that, you know, our senators and even the Trump administration is going to be looking at how can we recover and what does recovery look like? And I think that retraining workers to be in a better position will be a significant part of the recovery.
We do know that during recessions, people do tend to go back to college. And it certainly looks like Michigan and the country need to be at absolute minimum prepared for a possibility of a recession. Do you think that I had a question about Michigan's universities. Many of them have announced layoffs or hiring freezes of one kind or another. Do you think that the higher education system can be stabilized fast enough that this might still be workable?
For decades, you know, the government has been disinvesting in higher education. You know, we have seen drastic cuts. We have not kept up with pace. And so that financial burden has fallen on students and their families. And folks just haven't been able to afford getting a degree and credential. So I think that, you know, higher education is, you know, institutions are making really tough decisions because they have the, you know, responsibility of educating and providing top-notch training. And at the same time, the investment at the state level has not kept up. It hasn't kept to pace. And so I do think that there will be folks who say, I need to go get another degree or certification. And because of the expedited timeline for many of the eligible ReConnect programs, I think that this will be a very attractive active program for individuals who, again, fall in that 25 years or older, you know, demographic will really want to take advantage of. Because, you know, again, I think there has been a skills gap before the pandemic, and I think that this will just illuminate it even further.
At the same time, one of the financial pillars of the higher education system is federal aid. A great many students rely on something, whether it's Pell Grants or other kinds of tools to just get the money to cover tuition. What do you know about the state of federal financial aid right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that conversations are ongoing. And, you know, for those of us who have been in this work for a long time, I mean, we, you know, have been laser focused on protecting things like Pell, increasing the amount of student financial aid to make higher education a reality for, you know, students, particularly low income students, students who were first in their family to go to college. I mean, that is the demographic that I come from, right? You know, my parents and grandparents never went to college, but they told me that the pathway from poverty to prosperity would be linked to my ability to obtain a degree or credential. And I know that that degree that I received from Central Michigan University was my ticket to a better life. And as we see at the state and federal level, disinvestments in higher education, it's just making it more of a private good. So something that only the wealthy can receive, as opposed to a public good in which, you know, students of all income levels and races and regardless of their zip code should be able to obtain, again, that ticket into a life of prosperity, or at the very least, just the middle class. So I am concerned about, you know, disinvestments at both the federal and the state level. But that's the work that we're doing, is working to make sure that it's protected.
Sarah Anthony is a Democrat representing House District 68. Sarah, thank you so much for your time and for all your work in the legislature.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the time.
When we come back, we'll talk with two Detroit artists making and sharing work in a time of isolation and distress.
For my community, the pandemic has flipped everyone I know into survival mode.
Stay with us. That's coming up on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's so maddening that in this era when digital connections feel almost impossible to escape, COVID-19 stay-home orders are making us feel so isolated. Some Detroit artists and curators have created a new platform for people to share during the radical experience of separation and isolation that is this moment. The project is called 6 Feet of Distance. It's an experiment in sharing art and experiencing art at a time when shared experience is hard to come by. Sharina Sharp is a writer, editor, performer, and educator. She works with an art collective called The Tetra. Sharina, welcome.
Thank you.
And Kristen Lee is the head of The Room Project, a low-cost space for women and non-binary artists on Woodward Avenue in Detroit. Kristen, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, happy to be here.
You two are among the founding members of 6 Feet of Distance. Now, there's two ways we should probably talk about this moment. Number one, how it's affecting people's lives. And number two, how it's affecting people's art practice. Sharina, could I ask you first to tell us about what the pandemic has meant for the lives and livelihoods of the people that you know?
For my community, the pandemic has flipped everyone I know into survival mode at its most basic. So we're thinking about survival in the terms of breathing, taking breath. We're thinking about survival in the terms of livelihood and money and putting food on the table. Everything was canceled a month ago and everything stopped. And we had to start making decisions from a place where there's just wild consequences. It feels like there's big consequences to making hasty decisions. So we're thinking about everything with a certain gravity. There's a gravity in the air right now.
Kristen, what about you?
I teach a fiction class every week, and so it gives me the opportunity to check in with writers regularly. I find that there's a lot of similarities in a kind of fog that people have experienced, just the way that stress has kind of taken a toll on body productivity and in the way that COVID has touched their lives or loved ones, everything from the most banal, like just not being able to go out and hug friends, touch friends, be close, to yeah, the more profound things that people are dealing with and deeply afraid of, the fear, you know, job loss, death, all of it.
Certainly. Well, then let's turn this toward what people are doing with their time right now and the work itself. Sharina, would you say that artists you know are making in the same way or making the same kinds of things?
No, I wouldn't say that they're making in the same way. I think this process has been a really deep transformation. I think we're all asking ourselves, really, what did I come to this with? And now how do I deepen that practice? How do I use that to call forth whatever we are going to be on the other side of this? How is my gift going to foster this transformation?
Right. Kristen, what do you observe people working on right now? Do you see a shift in focus and just the kind of themes that are coming up?
I do. I see people honestly going deeper into their own sensed and lived experience. You know, there's not a lot of opportunity as artists to feel naive towards something, to feel that you get to engage in something that doesn't have a lot of rules yet, that doesn't have a lot of like form or protocol. And so there is this childlike attitude that I'm seeing, which is like the world is somewhat new, even if in that newness there's so much terror and trepidation, there's also this kind of play and strangeness and sense of discovery. And I am starting now that I think we can all sit down and formulate a full sentence, which certainly took a little bit of time.
Right.
I'm starting to see some really incredible writing.
6 Feet of Distance is a project that draws on a sector of art called social practice. And for those who aren't familiar with it, it's a practice that assumes the interactions that we have with other people have as much value and perhaps as much artistic value as some of the arts that the world traditionally considers more durable, things that are made like paintings and sculpture and installations and videos. So I just wondered, what did you have in mind when you started to think about a social practice project that would have meaning during COVID-19? Kristen?
Well, Michael Stone Richards and Steve Panton got a hold of me.
We should just explain, Steve is a longtime gallerist, and Michael has an academic background who's worked in a lot of contemporary art projects over the years.
Yes, both are fabulous scholars, writers, teachers, and they talked about 6 Feet of Distance operating as a kind of archive. And that was what began to anchor me, like a rhizomatic platform that would bring in all of these like nascent and developing conversations, different kinds of communication, all this experimentation as people are doing the work of translating their art and their lives.
Yeah.
And to capture all of these simultaneous narratives happening at the same time. To try to look at it all at one time, we probably can't do it in real time, but putting it on a platform means that in 6 months, in a year, you know, we can start to look back and see what was really happening. It's so hard to know what's actually happening when you're in the middle of a crisis.
Right. Sharina, would you explain the structure of 6 Feet of Distance and how we interact with it?
Absolutely. In the beginning, we got together and we decided we want to create a hub, a crossroad for artists who are creating during this time. How do we bring everyone together who are all speaking through their various mediums into one place? Detroit has in the past been incredibly divided, and to have a place where we all are facing the same problem at the same time and we can see each other, have each other's backs, became really important to us. So we started having discussions about how do you do that? We agreed together that the process would be completely and totally emergent, that it will change during the course of the pandemic. We're finding that information is coming at us like at mock speed, and trying to build something in the beginning that will stand up to whatever's going to be happening at the end is almost impossible.
Right.
Not, not something we're interested in. So the process is flowing, and it's totally responsive to the needs of the people who will be using the site. So artists, they will get in touch with us, and we will be happy to signal boost their work to make sure that they're not just speaking to their audience, but they're speaking to our collective and combined audiences. And we're asking that anyone in the public who knows of like just an amazing Detroit artist who's creating lets us know so we can reach out and link to them, and also for the public to tune in so we can create a conversation, you know, between artist and lawyer about how we're marking through all of this.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Sharina Sharp and Kristen Lee. They are among the co-founders of a new art project called 6 Feet of Distance, which is online, compiling experiences of artists and trying to provide some lifeline to artists around Detroit. So at present, at the website, you can find out information about what artists are doing, and you can also participate in certain artworks that people have created. I wanted to ask, Sharina, there was one that you curated. It's called Grandma's Hands Played a Tambourine So Well, Ritual 584.
It's the work of a group called the Tetra, and they are an underground group who curates freedom rituals, and I was lucky enough to be able to bring this work in.
The first part, of course, is a work of prose. And then the second part is this sort of set of directions of a way to remember, that being the social practice part of this work. Are you comfortable reading some of it for us?
Sure. Grandma's Hands Playing the Tambourine So Well, Ritual 584. Oh, beloved. There is no bond thicker with otherworldly love than the bond between grandparent and child. For me, first, it was my great-grandmother. When I'd come home from school, my great met me at the door on her horse. Her two-wheeled, ever-faithful steed was really a wheelchair, but you couldn't tell me nothing. As her hands lifted me into her lap, wheels moaning a tipsy blues song, the horse trotted us to her room. She'd rebraid my hair like hers, meticulous hands parting my crown down the middle, a braid on either side for balance. She'd sing, one side loves you soft, and the other side loves you powerful, protects you. See, the great shaman Maladoma Somme tells us, children are supernatural before our spirits are tamed. Newly born, children have so much news of the spirit world to share with elders who will one day return to the other side. I believe this is why I was so close to my great, why so many greats gravitate to newborns. Children come to love a softness into the twilight of our elders' lives. And elders teach children how to love our own hands in a world that abuses our magic.
That's an excerpt from Grandma's Hands Played a Tambourine So Well by the Detroit art collective The Tetra, read by Sharina Sharp. She's one of the curators behind 6 Feet of Distance, a new online art platform. Let's listen to a later platform of the piece. It suggests an action that anyone and everyone can perform.
Today's ritual is ancestor reverence. The spirit plane sends elders and mentors who see your spirit, and sometimes their family, and sometimes chosen family in the form of a teacher or a neighbor. There are guides who only love us stronger as they transition. And perhaps these politicians have never stopped to fully love their guides or to even recognize them. And this is the only explanation for how anyone would value profit over the power of a great-grandmother and her horse. So tonight, remember a story of an elder, whether a relative or not, who is the other half of your blood song. What do they teach you? What of their heart do you carry with you? Tonight, light a candle and out loud, thank your ancestor. Tell them how deeply you love them, knowing love is otherworldly. The Tetra.
So much going on there, Sharina Sharp. Some personal remembrance, as well as some real love for elders and the Black families who are under siege right now and losing so much. What do you see this work offering us in terms of a deeper understanding right now?
I think the work is a remembering of a spiritual technology that even in the face of the unimaginable of death, that there are still these ancestral bridges that we build that are incredibly powerful. And that power is going to be necessary to work our way through all of the devastation that we're seeing around us. How do we connect to the spiritual power that has always moved us through the unthinkable?
Kristen Lee, I wanted to ask you, there are many other kinds of work represented on 6 feet of distance, including one by Carlos Diaz called Detroit de Nuit, which is just photographs of night scenes in the city right now. How do you see a work like that bringing us a different lens to see things in this moment?
I think that seeing is connected to slowing down. And I would have never even let myself imagine a kind of moment like this, where I would have these vast horizons of time to sit and look and be contemplative. There are so many layers of stories contained in Detroit, in the walls, in the buildings, in the poems. To understand the vibrancy and the beauty of this city, it just takes time. And if you can sit down, it doesn't, you know, if your computer or if his photographs inspire you to go to these places and just sit and look, you know, art will change your life. We have this opportunity to just to stop and look. I mean, with all the tragedy that's happening, if we lose this opportunity to just look and look and look, we're fools.
Yeah. What does this moment of isolation mean to Detroit's art community as you experience it? Kristen, do you think you could answer that first?
You know, brass tacks, it's a time of insecurity and fear. Artists already live very, very close to the line of surviving. Honestly, a lot of grappling with how can we go forward? How can the art continue? How can we feed ourselves? How can we take care of each other? And honestly, how can we unite and make an argument for how artists need to be supported in this city financially, tactically, materially? How can that support happen?
Yeah. Sharina, how would you answer this question? You know, there's been several years now where the buzz around Detroit and its art scene was really very cachet. But I do wonder if, you know, if this moment just challenges what it means to live that life and not just capitalize on it.
That's a great question. I think to be an artist in Detroit at any time, you have to live and breathe creating. I think that there's a group of people who live here and who come here, and we share the spirit of taking everything that has tried to swallow us and making gospel out of it. That's what we do. So this is no different. It's just bigger. And it's so big that we're having to decide together, what are we going to do with this? What are we going to make out of this? How are we going to make sure everybody is here to create out of this? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we've not had to, we've been creating in silos, and we've been creating as if we're the only one. And we don't have that luxury anymore. We have to find each other.
I just have one last question. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about how you managed to get the project up and running relatively fast in the middle of the pandemic?
Yeah, I think the thing that I would just want to say is how fantastic our team is. Michael Stone Richards, Addie Langford, Steve Patton, Cece McGuire, who's the designer of the site, who made this site come together so quickly and with such finesse. Tricia Holt, who has done an arts calendar for a very long time, Art Detroit Now, that is doing so much work to try to kind of corral all the art, like virtual fine art that's happening through the city. Danny Van Zandt, who created this Detroit Cultural Crisis Survey that we're asking people to fill out. We're really trying to get as many narratives as possible to fill out that mosaic. Lee DeVito, editor-in-chief of Metro Times, who also is helping with the calendar and just, and then obviously like Sharina and Chase, but it's just, it's a really phenomenal team of people who really, really care about this, this art community.
Kristen Lee of Room Project and Sharina Sharp, the writer, editor, and curator and performer. They have been collaborating with a group of others on the art project 6 Feet of Distance, and you can find a link available on our website. Sharina, Kristen, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In just a moment, Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith stops by to share the latest info on rapid COVID-19 testing. And Representative Andy Levin checks in with the latest from Washington. Don't go away. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced a partnership with CVS Health to roll out rapid COVID-19 testing in Dearborn. Everybody, from state health officials to business owners to schools, has been clamoring for more information about who's got the virus and where it's spreading. The Abbott ID Now COVID-19 test offers super fast results in under 15 minutes, but Michigan Radio has learned this test's effectiveness at reading the spread of COVID is less impressive. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith joins us now with an update. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey.
We've heard a wide range of timing on COVID test results, from 2 weeks to now this, just 15 minutes. What are the differences in how these COVID tests are administered?
Yeah, so the administer, like when you go in to get the test, it's very similar. They have like a pretty giant swab that it sounds like they got to really cram in your nose to get the virus load out of there to be able to test it. The difference really comes down to, what do you do with that Q-tip or that test after you get the swab done? With this Abbott test, you can put it directly into a machine that is on site, and there's no like putting it into a viral medium, no vial. You don't have to send it in the mail. There's no like lab processing situation. You just can put it directly in the machine, and that makes it super quick.
So who's going to have access to this rapid test?
So you mentioned this expanded access in Dearborn, Michigan. It sounds like may want to start expanding that further, that there's some talk about expanding this with CVS to do these drive-through testing sites. The attraction there is, again, you're going to be a 30-minute turnaround time. Detroit was one of the first cities in the country to start using them at the beginning of this month. Mayor Mike Duggan, it sounds like, really tracked this down, especially at the time, because we had so many Detroit police officers with suspected cases or who were quarantined. So for first responders and healthcare workers who are, you know, trying to figure out if they can return back to work, that was kind of a big hit in Detroit.
So what are you hearing about the test effectiveness?
So NPR looked at this study from Cleveland Clinic this week that didn't look so hot. Basically, this study showed that 15% of the positive COVID samples that they ran through the Abbott system were missed. So Duggan, Mayor Mike Duggan, says at a briefing yesterday that he is aware of this particular, I don't know, issue, problem, but he stands by the test the way the city is using them, because the Cleveland Clinic study had the samples put into this viral medium to be sent off for processing instead of sticking the sample directly into the machine. That's what Detroit is doing, and that is what the CDC and the company that makes the tests are now advising Detroit and anybody who's using this test to be doing.
I am on the phone every day with national labs and national doctors, and I'm totally up on every test and its accuracy. And the Abbott tests, the way we are using them, have been certified as good as any test in the country. And I will talk testing until people are bored to tears. But as we've talked about before, testing for COVID-19 in this country is 90% accurate.
But that 90% accuracy rate, I mean, that's just not true. The CDC tests show the accuracy rate is much higher than that. There are definitely other tests that have a higher accuracy rate than 90%. But again, they're not nearly as fast. So the Abbott testing isn't going to tell you someone who has COVID that doesn't. They just might miss someone who does. Detroit is using these to screen these frontline workers, or in the future, they could send them out into neighborhoods. So these machines are mobile, and that might help testing rates. But, you know, accuracy is important. So it's something that people definitely want to keep an eye on. There's places like the Cleveland Clinic that are not using these Abbott tests anymore at all.
Lindsay, we have less than a minute left. Can you remind us why these numbers matter so much?
The accuracy rate, I mean, is super important because if you don't really want people to fall through the cracks, right? If you get a false negative, so you are reassured that you do not have COVID-19, and then you act as if you don't have COVID-19 in returning to the workforce or having contact with your family members or people who are vulnerable, immunocompromised, I mean, that's sort of the scary part there, right? But as far as we can tell, it's sort of a balancing act of how accurate we can possibly get with also being able to test as many people as we possibly can.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith. Lindsay, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Congress is sprinting to approve a second coronavirus aid package, this one worth $483 billion. The deal would replenish the fund that small businesses apply to for keeping payroll solvent. It would also pump more money into hospitals and testing programs. It's likely this will not be the last form of aid that Congress sends to the states. The Senate approved the package on Tuesday, and the House wants lawmakers to get back in town for a Thursday vote. With us now, on his trip back to Washington, is 9th District Congressman Andy Levin. Congressman, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. It's great to talk to you again.
What do you think should be the priorities going forward? Do you feel like this bill is a proper step in the proper direction?
Well, this is really an interim package. We have really much more to do, but I certainly support this bill because, you know, it helps our hospitals, our hospital workers. It helps our small businesses. And, you know, it really forces the administration to get going on a national approach to testing. So while there's many more things we have to do, these are all good things. And so I'm very supportive of getting them done. And I appreciate our leadership for getting it done, because what the Senate first proposed was nothing like what we're passing tomorrow. So it's been much improved by Democrats in the Senate and the House working together.
We've seen some reports that there has not been a lot of agreement for a clear path on the next round of stimulus. Can you tell us a little bit about your priorities?
Absolutely. So number one, I introduced a bill along with three of my colleagues from really across the country to pump money to smaller governments. The CARES Act included a significant amount of money for state stabilization funding, but it really just went to states and local governments of 500,000 or more. Well, in Michigan, that's the city of Detroit, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Kent County. That's it. And all those governments, I want to help. But like in the 9th District, all 21 of my local jurisdictions obviously are smaller than that, as, you know, are 79 of our 83 counties and all the rest of our cities and townships. So our proposal is to provide $250 billion to governments that are smaller than 500,000 population, and we need to let them use the funds to make up for revenue they've lost, and not just to do what the CARES Act allowed, which is pay for things that have specifically not been budgeted before, but came up during this crisis. Well, your police, your EMT, your fire was already budgeted before, but you're hemorrhaging. You know, so we have to provide money there. We need to save our postal service and our postal workers.
Now that more people are getting packages than ever before. We've heard from
also,
a number of...
Yeah, April, we need to have everybody be able to vote by mail. Everybody. So we can't do that without the Postal Service. For a lot of reasons. Yeah.
Good luck getting the Senate on board with that. We've heard from a number of business owners who were not able to apply on the first round of Paycheck Protection Program, and they're concerned that they might miss out on the second round as well. It seems possible that some of these businesses just won't make it. Is this just going to be a first come, first serve game of survival as long as funds are available?
Well, it's still far from perfect, and I would, you know, like to take a different approach, but this is the essence of what we accomplished on the small business side. The House Democrats basically said, look, we are not just going to put more money in there so the lion's share of it can go to Ruth Chris Steakhouse and these other, you know, big chains that are getting millions and millions of dollars. And the local barbershop and independent restaurant and nail salon and so forth can't get anything. So we set aside $60 billion of this money for smaller lending institutions and smaller businesses to, you know, smaller credit unions, smaller banks. And they are specifically going to provide the money to small businesses. I still worry about the justice of it, April. If you're an unbanked business, it's great that we're giving some of the money to institutions that may give you a look. But this has been, I mean, look, the crisis is phenomenal. And I don't begrudge a medium-sized business for getting, you know, getting help. I want them to. But we really should be helping the smallest businesses first. This is a big step in that direction. It's still not perfect. And the money's going to run out and, you know, in a matter of days or weeks. And we're still, you know, going to have a lot of work to do.
We didn't plan this, but we're having this conversation with you on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And you published a statement calling for better treatment of the natural world. At the same time, we just heard that there's the systematic weakening of regulation at the US EPA has had a negative impact on the Great Lakes. Do you think there's any way to get back what we've lost?
There certainly is a way to get back what we've lost. And in a way, this crisis gives us a little inkling of it, doesn't it? Because all of us have seen so much reporting about people seeing more animals, people in Kathmandu seeing the Himalayas for the first time, people from Los Angeles to Delhi having much less smog. This is something, if we realize that if we take a systematic approach to our environment, and not just, yes, we should all carry reusable water bottles and reusable bags, but Earth Day can't just be about our individual practices. If we get rid of this government on November 3rd and get a government that will actually put the economy put the environment at the center of our economic life, we could tackle climate change and build an economy that's based on renewable energy, on great union jobs for people, you know, making the environment safe for generations to come. And there's no alternative. There's no planet B, April. Let's get about it. And absolutely we can do it if we put our minds to it. And if we take collective action, not just individual action, to save our planet.
As people probably guessed, you are in the car right now, headed back to Washington, D.C. Congress.
Not the best connection, but
that's okay.
I'm on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
That's okay.
Back to D.C.
You know, this is not a particularly easy time for folks to be doing that commute, going to the nation's capital one day to handle votes and business, and then returning to districts to do the necessary work that constituents badly need right now. Have you been driving back and forth the whole time?
Well, this is only I did a 30-hour solo round trip when we passed the last bill, and now I'm doing it now. I mean, each of us handles it in our own way. You know, my dad's 88, and two of my kids have Crohn's disease and are immunocompromised. And so I personally feel like, even though I don't discourage others from flying, I just need to take every precaution. So I'm in my UAW-made Ford Explorer COVID-free cocoon driving by myself to D.C., and that's the way I could do it to, you know, keep my family safe. But I'm glad you raised our work at home, because I've never seen anything like this, April. Of course, our office is closed physically, but my staff is working so hard. Our phone line in D.C. and in Warren is picked up. Each of them is picked up every hour, all the messages. And my constituents, all of our constituents, need help. They need that unemployment insurance check. They need to get that small business forgivable loan. They've got family members stuck in Peru or the Philippines trying to get home. So the work of a congressperson really is partly about making policy in Washington, but honestly, a lot of it is about just helping our constituents, the American people, you know, get what they need to survive through a crisis like this. And it's an honor to do it.
House leadership is working on a plan that would allow representatives to vote by proxy. Do you support remote voting right now?
You know, I do, April, and I hope that we get this proxy thing done today. If not, I mean, tomorrow when we vote. But I don't understand why we wouldn't. You know, this is a crisis. They can put ironclad language in there that says we're only doing this because of this huge crisis, and we won't do it in normal times. But really, the Congress needs to continue its oversight work of the administration. We need to keep making policy for the country. And so I think we have the technology in 2020 to function remotely in a secure way. And I totally support Jim McGovern, the chair of the Rules Committee, and Zoe Lofgren, the chair of the House Admin Committee, as they try to stand up new ways for us to operate so we can get the people's business done during this pandemic.
This issue's been really divided on party lines, though. What about the criticism that Speaker Pelosi pushed the issue of remote voting really hard during the earlier stimulus vote? I mean, should this be a top priority when hospitals in Michigan are laying off thousands of employees and a quarter of the state's workforce is unemployed?
I don't get the connection, April.
Well, was this the right time? Was this the right time to draw the line in the sand on remote voting?
Well, if we want to help the hospitals and the people, we have to do our business. We have to take care of the people's business. And it doesn't really get the people's business done faster by waiting for remote voting. It's quite the opposite. The more convenient we make it for people to vote on bills and do committee work, the more aggressively we can respond to this crisis. That's the way I view it anyway.
Congressman Levin, thank you so much for taking the call, even though you're multitasking your way to D.C. right now. We appreciate it.
You're so welcome, April. Thanks for your great reporting. We need real facts from the media so much today, and I appreciate your great work.
Stay safe.
Thanks.
We just want to say we really appreciate all the stories that folks send in about how their families are doing, what their businesses are going through. You can email us stateside@michiganradio.org or reach out to us on Twitter @StatesideRadio. That's our show for today. Tomorrow, we're going to be touching base with a few more of Michigan's small businesses as everyone struggles to retool during the shutdown. We'll hear from a personal trainer and a bar owner, all figuring out how to maintain some professional normalcy with physical distancing.
In a bar where we have pool tables and a live music room, to try to tell people stay 6 feet away from each other is going to be really difficult.
I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow. Take care.